Therefore, excommunicating. He says, just don't put him in leadership, because if the dependents in his household have not been indoctrinated and they're not loyal to the scriptures and living the scripture way, there's a too high a probability that he's not going to be able to do it with others either. He's not going to be successful in the church. So don't put him in church leadership. But it's a question of probability. And that's why I can't say for sure ever. Now, there's a defiant teenager, and I know for sure that it's because his parents blew it. Now, I know for sure that they blew it in some ways. Right? All human parents blew it in some ways. But that child has a free will, too. But there's a question of probability when it comes to church leadership. I'm told that one of the more accurate indexes of whether a person will make a good church leader or not is to look at their home. And if you look at their home and the dependents are doing well, there's a high probability this guy will be able to do the same job in the church. But if you look at a church leader and his dependents are not doing well, the probability is he's not going to be any more effective in the church. So don't pick him for church leadership. Now the problem, the rub in this whole thing comes because we choose church leaders at a far earlier age than they did back in the first century. See? We pick them a lot younger before their families are developed. And a big reason is that is because we don't start our families until later. Back in those days, they started their family at 13, 14, 15. So by the time a guy was 30, you know, he had dependents, and you could look at his home. But nowadays, you know, we're at the point now where, you know, we don't start our families till 22 or 23. And when a guy's out of seminary, he's ready to church leadership, there's nothing to look at yet. So you've got the problem then of it after the fact. And Paul doesn't address that in 1 Timothy 3. He's addressing before the fact, not after the fact. And so how you solve that problem, I've got my own opinions, but I don't think Paul really says it. So I'm not going to go on, I won't say anymore. But that, you know, I have to do the same thing Paul did in that passage, is when I'm working with parents, work at helping them improve what they can improve. Well, there's some cultural problems. I'm not exactly sure what all your sins is, but let me move on here, okay? And talk about just the fact that not only do parents not really know what adolescent needs are, but so often they're not sure even how to react to adolescent reasoning, adolescent thinking. In that book I mentioned yesterday, Educating for Moral Responsibility by Nicholas Wolterstorff, he's a Christian educator. He mentions in there that one of the best methods for developing moral tendencies is what he calls induction. And research has shown over and over again that induction is powerful, and that is this. It's inducing someone to be obedient to a set of standards by giving them reasons why they ought to keep it. That's called induction. Inducing someone to be obedient to a set of standards by giving them reasons why they ought to keep it. Now, that's what parents are really poor at. They're really poor at induction, I have found. They don't know how to respond to adolescent reasoning. I used to do this, and I even find the list in my files probably today, but at one point I collected a list of 37 reasons why Scripture gives why premarital sex shouldn't be entered into. See, Paul gives reasons all the time, so does Scripture. Scripture is full of inducing us to obedience. It doesn't only give us a standard, but it goes on and induces us to obey by giving us reasons. Proverbs is full of reasons of why we ought to obey. And so there are just dozens of reasons Scripture gives why premarital sex is not a good idea. Recently, I was with a group of parents, and I said, we were talking about dating, and I was saying, let's say that we tell our kids, we sit down and we give them a standard of where they should go in premarital sex. What do you think is a good standard? And it was quiet. I said, well, just give me some ideas of what you've told your kids. What kind of standards have you given them? And talk to our kids about it. Okay, well, let's say you were going to meet with them and talk with them, and you set some standards up. What reasons would you give them why they shouldn't enter into having intercourse before marriage? Well, let's list some biblical reasons here. If you don't remember the passage, it's okay. But just let's list them, okay? Go ahead. Just shout them out. And we wonder why our kids are involved in premarital sex. For one thing, no one's ever drawn a line for them and give them a standard. And for number two is no one's ever induced them to keep the biblical standard. And that's where parents really blow it. They just don't know how to deal with adolescent reason. Well, why can't I go and have sex with my... Not too many says that, but they will ask questions. And instead of parents sitting down and reasoning with them and talking. Now, I'm not saying, you know, Proverbs tells us that you can't correct a servant with mere words. Reasoning isn't enough. You've got to go to the next step and have a strategy for responding to defiance. But the thing is, we miss it by leaving out reasoning entirely. We've got to teach parents how to talk to their kids and how to answer their kids' questions. I mean, Moses thought of that back in Deuteronomy 6, and he says, and when your kids ask, why in the world do we keep these standards, you induce them to keep them by giving them these reasons. Scripture's full of reasons. And we don't teach our parents how to do induction very well. Yeah, and that's why it comes down to the final one. There has to be a biblical strategy for responding to adolescent rebellion, because it's, one teenage strategy is, I don't understand or I don't buy it. And you don't have to agree with me. You have to agree with the standard, but you will keep it, or else you'll experience pain. That's what I'm here to make sure you do. You will experience pain for adolescent rebellion. And parents just really don't have an idea at all of how to apply discipline. I was talking on discipline recently, and a mother raised her hand and says, I think I got a good example of what you're talking about. And I said, well, go ahead and give it. And she says, Our son's job is to fill up the pitcher with ice and water about 15 minutes before dinner, so it's nice and cold, and he's to have it on the table when we all sit down to eat. And this past summer, there's about the third or fourth day in a row that he'd forgotten to do this, and so we had warm water. And as we sat down, one of the kids said, oh, do we have to drink warm water again? And you know, it just angered me so much that I picked the pitcher up and I poured it over his head. And she said, do you think that, now isn't that a good example of how to respond when our kids disobey us? You know, it kind of took me back. Kind of took me back a little bit. I didn't know how to answer. I was speechless. But you will find just an amazing number of dumb things being done. Now, what we got to remember is underneath those things, the reason why so often they're not thinking clearly is because of fear and disappointment. And these strategies, even though we're going to show them and give them a biblical strategy for responding to adolescent needs, reasoning, and rebellion, remember, they're not going to be able to use them unless there is a commitment to move away from self-protective devices within the tent. They just won't be able to use them very appropriately. But we still have to teach them and show them that this is what a lack of distance between you and your kids means. It means that if you're not distant from your kid, when he brings up objections and says, why shouldn't I do this? You're not going to move away by saying, because I said so, that's it. And don't ever let me hear you question God's word again in this house. See, that's distance. That's fear. And staying involved in reasoning with the children, reasoning with the teenagers, is a much better response. Now, let's talk about Roman numeral number 4. Would you like to take a little break? Okay. Is that a unanimous opinion? Okay. Okay. Responding then, or this whole thing of offering the kind of help parents will seek out and receive. Some of this is review. I've touched upon this before, but let me just quickly go through it. The focus of the material, as you advertise it, is on parenting skills, how to parent. You're not going to find people this age that are normally going to come out to work on their own lives. I'm sorry to say that, but that's not going to be the initial motivation for them to come out. You're going to find very few. But they will come out because they're terrified that their kids are going to go bad. And you're going to offer them, supposedly, some way for them to keep their worst fears from being realized. That'll be their motivation for coming out. And so, you know, I believe there's really two teachable moments in the life of a parent, generally speaking. One is within the first few months before or after the birth. And the other is the first few weeks after the first real episode of adolescent rebellion. Those are the two most peaceful moments. Because that's when parents are scrambling the most. Their fears are the biggest. That's when they're most willing to admit they don't have it together. During the elementary ages, usually they're ready to write their own book. That's where I'm at. My kids are 7, 5, 7, and 10. And I want to get my book out real quick before I realize I don't know anything. This is a point at which people become more teachable, is during the period of time where they begin to experience adolescent rebellion. And they might have already raised two kids, and they were compliant kids and great. But the third one comes along, and now all of a sudden they're teachable. You see? Now all of a sudden they're asking for help. And they will come out if they believe what you're offering as parenting. For the same age group, you could offer discipleship groups or growth groups or whatever, and you're going to find a whole lot less of a draw. But you will find them coming out of fear for this. And I think that we can use that as a way of getting in contact with them and helping. The same thing, motivation for counseling. So few counselors will come to you because they genuinely want to become more godly. It's usually because there's some crisis they're facing and they want you to help them get better. You need to realize that that's what they're coming for and address that. And so it needs to be a practical course on parenting. A course where you really get into the issues and give them examples of what they're dealing with. The content of the course is really to be geared to more than anything else, is to arouse an appetite. Arouse an appetite in the parents for maturity in their own lives. That's the basic direction you're going with the course, to arouse an appetite. I want them coming out of the course asking more questions. They usually come in, you know, looking for a few answers. I want to come out asking more questions. In other words, here's the thing that the pull I feel from parents to teens is that they want me to do their thinking for them. And what I want to teach them to do in the course is to get them started on doing their own thinking about how to be parents. So I want to be careful that I don't give into the pull to give them this cookbook approach, but that I really want to challenge them to be the kind of parent that requires a lot of thinking and a lot of maturity on their own, and which is going to be the hook to get them into some of our other programs, which are designed. See, this is a lecture course where we have a lot of discussion, and so we're not going to be able to do a whole lot in that initial course to do any of our three basic purposes, dealing with denial and disappointment and distance. But hopefully this initial course, if not the end, see, then that's so often what I find is the biggest mistake with parenting courses, is they're seen as an end to themselves. And I have taught dozens of parenting teens courses that were set up to be an end in themselves, and they never seem to produce much fruit. And I always wonder, why in the world are parents going out and being different? And I realize that's just the front end. That's just the door into our ministry to them. And through the course, if we can just build an appetite for maturity, because I want to be that kind of parent, and an appetite for, I want to be able to think in those kind of principles to be able to make those decisions about my kids myself. I want to be able to be able to sit through and think, what is the best response in a given situation? I want to be able to do that. I want to be free enough from my fears to be able to do that. That's what my goal is, that there's that desire that's been lit in as many as possible by the end of the course. And therefore, they're going to take advantage of other kinds of ministries we have available to them from then on. So that's just our front end. And so we don't try to give the final answers in a lot of the areas. We try to build that kind of curiosity. Credible leadership. Now, that's tough. I have experimented a lot with this. And I have come to the conclusion now, and I'll probably change next month, but my conclusion right now is that the best leadership for a course is a pastor with a team of parents of teens working together and teaching the course. Now, I have found it to be an advantage not to have teenagers myself right now and be teaching the course. And I have seen people come in that have parents, and there seems to be more of a reaction, especially if they know they're teenagers, because they know that their teenagers are made of clay and they have their problems too. But there's a sense in which, you know, I don't have to be up there and have them evaluating a job I've done. I'm building on the principles of scripture, and they're not saying, now wait a minute, I know his kids, and his kids, you know, that kind of thing. But at the same time, I like the realism, the realistic thing of having many, many transit teams involved in helping to teach the course. So we do a number of role plays, and I have a team of about 6 parents that help me teach the course, and they do role playing set up, and they teach certain sections. They take small parts of it. But I do the bulk of the teaching of the class. I've tried panels, and I've tried situations, and I've just found it's just not healthy to put anyone up there that really hasn't, as far as in a teaching kind of role or a question answering role, that really hasn't been trained and discipled or really think in the model. Okay, I need to make that some very sacred thing, but what I basically mean is to think in biblical principles of parenting, because I just have heard in over the years in open group things where parents going to sit around and share with each other things they've tried and things that work. I have heard the dumbest, most destructive things shared. And so I stay away from having those kind of situations where we're just going to get a bunch of parents together and we'll put our heads together and what do you do in this kind of situation? Well, I did this. I poured water with my kids and it worked. You know, there's just too many parents sitting there that might even really try that. So I really try to screen who I let up in front and what they talk about. And so we work with a team of parents that have been trained, and as of yet, none of them are at the point where they are ready for the primary teaching roles, but I hope soon, by the time I take the team, hope they will be, so I can start taking the course. Question?
I've got one, but I don't know how to ask it, so
go on. Okay. The packaging of the course has to be done in a way that's non-threatening and somewhat convenient for them to attend. Go ahead. Well, my feeling is this, is that a youth pastor needs to be doing at least 50% of his work with adults. Now, he needs, and that's the biggest mistake I see youth workers making, is that, and what I see is youth work often becomes a wrong strategy. I'm afraid to work with people my age. I feel, like I can control kids, and I love the way they look at me and admire me, so I'm going to stay in youth work, and they don't realize that a good, effective youth worker does at least half his work, if not three-fourths of it, with adults. Because he loves the kids so much, he wants to reproduce himself, so he's got to be working with adults. Now, if a youth worker is committed to doing that, I think within a 3 to 5 year period, he can build up the kind of rapport and confidence to begin to move into this kind of ministry. But, his chronological age doesn't count near as much. But if anybody goes home, I don't care if they've been in youth work for 10 years and they just haven't worked with parents at all, and you try to walk into this kind of thing, you probably won't have the credibility. You need to move and work into it in smaller ways. And one of the best ways I think parents can start is just start meeting with parents a lot more one-on-one. Just start doing maybe a once-a-month kind of little workshop with parents. And begin to teach and interact with them and roll with them and learn to see how they think and what kind of questions they ask them and figure out yourself what are the answers to these questions. Because when you get up to begin to teach a course, then you need to be able to teach with some conviction and authority and be able to answer questions, because they can tell right away whether you're coming at it from a kind of an ivory tower because you read one book and you've never really had to wrestle with these things. They can tell it right away and they'll turn you off. In our particular parenting course, we have doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists and school principals and they ask good questions. But they're scared to death, because they're professionals and they really don't have any idea what to do with the rebelling adolescents. One of our couples in our team that's learning to train to lead this ministry is a psychologist, a PhD. When I began working with him, he didn't have the foggiest idea what to do with parents of teens when they came in his office for counseling. Just didn't even have the foggiest, never got any training in that. So he kind of avoided those situations. Now he's got his own teenagers, and he says, I can't avoid it any longer. I got to learn this stuff. I got to find out how. And he's become one of my strongest leaders in the parenting teens ministry. But I'll tell you, when he was sitting in that course, the first time that he was sitting there just scribbling everything down. Because he said, man, I got parents I'm going to see tomorrow. I got to tell them this. I was telling Larry yesterday, we were talking a little bit about the response we had to the Counseling Adolescent course these couple days. And I said, I'm really surprised because, you know, I feel like I know so little about this topic because it is such a, adolescence and parenting adolescence is so complicated and there's just no easy handles to it. And it's all real messy. And I don't ever sit down with a set of parents to come in that I don't feel some degree inadequate and I'm not sure what to do and just questions and that. But, you know, I've met so few people that have thought through the issues anywhere close to where I'm at, and I feel like, you know, I'm not very far along. And I'm just amazed from working with the people in institutions and professionals in our area how so little they've thought about adolescence and how to advise parents and teens, just so little. So while I'm saying that to encourage you, that it doesn't take years and years and years to develop this kind of mystery of parents and teens. If you begin to think in this and read a little bit and study the scripture and start to develop some convictions, I think that a ministry can open up to you in a relatively short period of time if you get involved gradually and study in that. We do need a whole lot more people doing it. Just need a whole lot more people doing it. Our ministry has been rolling for less than a year, and we are just inundated right now with counseling, with parents and teens, and requests for counseling. And it's a need, and I believe it's going to be one of our most effective routes to evangelism in the community. You know, this is where unsaved people aren't afraid to turn to the church and ask for help. They really aren't. Now, let's talk about this basic course of parents and teens in the church. Let me just tell you the five units that we teach in about 12 weeks. Here are the five units. The first unit is a unit that we call looking at the world through the eyes of an adolescent. Looking at the world through the eyes of an adolescent. And all we're trying to do here is helping the parent begin to see, number one, what are the needs of an adolescent? And number two, why is it inevitable that your adolescent is going to be a big, big disappointment to you? This is where we share with them the personal social crises and the task of adolescence. And we spend, during this first unit, about 30 minutes looking at Proverbs chapter 19 and 20. That's two great chapters for parents. And the reason it is, if you just want to teach a very simple IBC model to the parents, if you just want to teach them the fact that all behavior is teleological, meaning it's connected to something deeper and that there's purposes in our hearts, and that your teenager's behavior is not arbitrary, but it has a logic to it. It has a logic to it because your adolescents have needs, they have something they're looking for, and the way Proverbs 19 says is what a man desires is unfailing love. And I use that verse to say, this is what our kids are thirsting for. They're looking for it. And the ways they learned as a child to get unfailing love doesn't work. Now they're looking for new ways. And they come up with all kinds of ideas of how they're going to find unfailing love. Now, when you see an arbitrary behavior, you can bank on the fact that somehow it's tied into this search for unfailing love. You can bank on it. And then it says in Proverbs 20 that a man of wisdom can learn to draw these out. And you can learn to begin to read your kids' hearts. You can begin to learn to understand your kids on a deeper level. And then it goes through and gives several significant ways, like listening and different kinds of things that you can do to begin to get a feel for what's in your kids' heart. So Proverbs 19:20 is a great chapter to walk through with parents. Now the second unit that we teach is how an adolescent decides what kind of person he wants to be. How an adolescent decides what kind of person he wants to be. And in this unit, we teach all about teenage foolishness. And we talk about the rational circle. Now, I don't use that terminology, rational circle. Okay, but I do talk about how an adolescent mind works. And I talk about what foolishness is. And at this point, we try to spend some time defining for the parent what their job is. And we try to redefine it from controlling or shaping their kid's behavior to shaping their kid's heart. And that becomes the whole theme of our course. As a parent, my job is to be the kind of parent and provide the kind of environment that shapes my kid's heart conviction. That's my goal. I want to get to his heart. And that becomes kind of the hallmark or the sentence, the trademark of our course. We use some different passages there, but we draw a whole lot from Hosea chapter 6 during that time. Now, from there, we move in to a unit called Constructing a Home Environment that Gives My Kid or Your Kid His Best Chance. Constructing a Home Environment that Gives Your Kid His Best Chance. Now, those words, their titles, are chosen very deliberately because what we want to do is we want to be sure not to teach the parents that this is a guaranteed formula. It gives your kid a chance, but it's still his own choice whether he wants to be godly or not. But this is the kind of home environment that gives him his best chance. You see, there's no guarantees, even if you provide a high, high home environment. But it gives him his best chance at being obedient. There we talk about the four environments. We go through and we talk about what each of those environments are, and we talk very specifically with lots of examples of what it means to be a high-low parent, a low-low parent, and a low-high parent. Okay? And we talk about those, and this is a real time where what we're doing in this unit is trying to break through denial. We're trying to give them a picture of themselves. We do a lot of laughing, a lot of role-playing, and they start to see themselves. That's me. That's the kind of home environment I'm providing, you know. So this is, we find by the third unit, we're starting to melt some of the layers, and we try to make this kind of light and humorous so that they can kind of laugh at themselves and we can kind of humor home the truth there. But there's a lot of despair during this time. Parents really get concerned that, you know, I haven't provided a good relationship for my kids. It's at this point then, at the end of this unit, that we spend at least an hour, at least 1 week, on a healthy marriage relationship and the importance that is as a prerequisite. We call that the prerequisite to providing a healthy home environment. This is part of Unit 3. This is the end of Unit 3. You know, the prerequisite to constructing a home environment that gives your kid his best chance is a healthy marriage. And we use, during that time, we use Larry Circle. I don't really have time to get into too much on that, but you could use material on a marriage builder on that. And I'm convinced that most of these parents would not come out if we offered a 12-week course in marriage. This group, now we get some, but this group wouldn't come out because their marriages, to some degree, you know, in a lot of the cases, are working. You know, but there's role reversal and that kind of stuff in there. But this gives us a point now to get to people who are somewhat satisfied in their marriages, they're just scared about their kids. But their marriages are really, you know, aligned kind of grossly. Is that an adjective? Aligned kind of in an unhealthy way. Then our fourth unit is how to be deeply involved with your adolescent. Okay, so this is all on involvement. And if you recall, I put these goals up yesterday of what it meant to be highly involved with your adolescent. And for each of these, we teach skills. And we go through, because what I want to do is I want to show them, you know, what it means to be close to your kids. What it means to be involved, and what this is a time of exposing the fact that there's distance, that there's real distance. And why is there distance? We talk about that during this time. Why is it so hard to be involved with our kids on this level? So we kind of look back and we get curious on this, but I put up the skills specifically for each one of these goals in order for them to really get the idea, that's what it means to really be involved with my kids. That's hard. Now, some of these skills are basic skills that we've learned in the IVC model. For the first one, to understand my kids in their world, we talk about giving focused attention. We talk about listening underneath words and giving your kids door openers. Those are the three skills for the first goal. Focused attention, listening underneath words, and giving your kids door openers. Now for the second one, the three skills we teach are physical contact, shared experiences, and immediacy, or addressing the problem of the moment in your kids. How to be immediate with them as far as what's going on in the here and now. Physical contact, shared experience, and immediacy. In the third area, the three skills we try to teach are self-disclosure, staying layer-free, and communicating respect. You know, you can slice the pie any way you want and call them anything you want, but that's how we divide the skills up, and that's how we try to teach them. Now again, here our goal is to just define what we mean by closeness. What do we mean by being involved with your kids? Because we want to expose the fact that this is difficult to do. And then we can just kind of sit back and chew a little bit in the class of why is this so hard to be involved with our kids? And it comes back to disappointment. We lead the discussion back to disappointment. And this is a point at which we look at a healthy model of involvement. And this is usually at the end of this point we look at Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane and how he stayed involved even in the midst of disappointment. He stayed involved. This is 4. This is still on how to be deeply involved with your kids. Now, the last unit is how to be highly responsive to your kids. How to be highly responsive. Remember the high home environment, high involvement, high responsiveness? The last unit is how to be highly responsive to your kids. And during this time that we go through and we teach 5 basic skills around those kind of goals. You know, we teach, and really, it's kind of involved in trying to tell you what these skills are. But if you notice, the key words here are affirmation, awareness, and the whole thing of attaching significance, which I think we're using the word now, association is the word we use. Associating, so they associate certain actions with the right heart attitude and what God thinks about that heart attitude. That's association. So we teach basic skills of how to do that. I won't go into all the skills that we have there because it would take a while, but we try to teach them some basic skills of how to affirm your children, how to create an awareness in them that are really deeper parts, that they are volitional, that they can think on their own, that they can make impact. And we try to teach them then to associate certain attitudes, heart attitudes and directions, with what God thinks about them and what God will say the ultimate consequence will be if you move out in that selfish direction. Now this is where discipline comes in. This is where the whole area of correction. This is where we begin to get into the teaching the skills of discipline under that one. Now this course, we've learned a lot of things because we've taught it 3 times this year to parents. And every time they fail an evaluation, we have a lot of interaction. We've learned a whole lot of things, and we're revamping it this summer. I think we'll keep these 5 basic units, but we're putting it into a notebook and that kind of thing. And I told the class yesterday or the day before, if you want to write me in that and get a notebook, we'll send them out. We'll sell them. Well, no, because I'll lose it. Be better to write me a letter, and that way my secretary gets the letter, she'll put it in file and make sure it gets there. If you give me a note today, I'll end up in some file and I'll forget to take it out. Of the course? Might be parenting teams. I don't know. That's what it is right now. Oh, I don't know. That's on the drawing board. I don't know. We've got so many weird ones there. I'll give you my address at the end. Just remind me. Okay? Now, while we teach this unit then, again, we say, hey boy, that's really hard to do, and we look at how Nehemiah did it, and there's a great, Nehemiah, there's a lot of great passages there to show where Nehemiah got his strength, and how he got the strength to stay responsive to people, even in the midst of disappointing. And we try to come back to that. Now again, we're not going to be doing any deep counseling during this, but we're creating appetite. I want to respond to my family like Christ responded to his disciples in the garden. I want to respond like Nehemiah did. You know, but boy, I have a lot of work to do on maturity. I'm not very mature. I'm just starting to learn that. And if I'm going to be an effective parent, I've really got to work at maturity in my own life. Well, I've got to spend a lot more time thinking about it. And now we've got the hook, see? Because we want to lead them into one of our other ministries then. And you might turn the page and you'll see that what our primary thing is to get them in a small group. Yeah, number 5, that was how to be highly responsive to your adolescent. Now, with the small group, we see this as a big key. Parents, I'll clue you in that parents of adolescents hate groups. And they will try to stay away from them if they can all avoid it. We thought that this was a neat idea when we thought it up. We thought, boy, the parents would go to these in hordes, but they're really scared to. They want to, but they're really scared to. And we find it as a key thing, and we started giving individual counseling without requiring to be in groups, and we saw that we're really allowing the parents to circumvent what was a very important step for them, and that was to go public. To go public with the fact that they think they have problems. So you can go to a course on parenting teens and pretend like, oh, you know, we just want to sharpen, polish things up. When you get in a group and say, there are some maturity issues that I've got to look at. As a result of this course and that kind of thing, there are some areas that I'm struggling and I need help. You know, that is a step away from self-protection in itself. That's a cliff. An important step that's needed. And we found that, it does this thing too. That so often, you know, there's role reversal and the kids have control of home, and one of the main tools they use to get control is, if you let me do what I want to do, I won't go public and embarrass you. You see? Like, you know, the parents are scared up to really come down with discipline because, you know, a kid could run away and we could get our name in the paper. Or everybody at church might find out what's going wrong. And so everything stays quiet and the parents slowly retreat, hoping that by giving their kids ground, their kids will somehow reciprocate by not getting into any more trouble and embarrass them. And we found that this automatically takes one of the best tools away from the kids by the parents already facing the humiliation of going public and saying, we've got problems at home, by being in a small group. Now, we don't put their name in the bulletin or anything like that, but even with three or four other couples of parents being in a group, it's an important step because now they're saying, hey, listen, you know, I went ahead and I admitted it, and it's not going to destroy me, so go ahead. You know, I'm going to be the parent I know I need to be, and if you want to end up in jail, my name gets in history, I can handle that. And that's an important step for parents to be able to cross that thing. So groups are important. The problem is having qualified leaders for the groups. And, you know, up till now, I've been leading the groups, but I have in training six couples that will lead the groups eventually. And what we have on the drawing board for this fall is that each of those two couples will help me lead a group in doing it. So we're working on that. Yeah, three groups is what we aim at doing. And what happens is that about half of the way through the parenting adolescent course, we offer the groups. The groups start. What's that? Our church, how large it is? Yeah, our church is a church of about 6,000 people. And again, you know, of course, we've got more resources as a larger church, but we've got more people, too. You've got a smaller church, you don't need as many personnel in that kind of thing. You've got a real advantage. Maybe you can only go with, you only need one group to go with, that kind of thing. This year, on Friday mornings for our community, I taught a course called Counseling Adolescents, and I had about 20 youth pastors from churches all around our area come in, and some lay people came in, and one couple came in. Well, in fact, it was just the mother because the husband worked. It was just the wife, and she has two teenagers of her own, and they go to a small church, and they're the youth sponsors. She heard about this course and came, and about halfway through began to implement these things. And they have a thriving parent and teen ministry now in just about 6 months. And she and her husband taught the course, the parent and teen course, and now they got two groups going. And she's just raving about the fact that it's just turned their youth group around. So it is possible to do it on a small church basis. We've seen in several small churches that they've done it. In fact, I think in some ways it's a little easier on that.
I don't know if it's just a small church idea. For me, I look at this like this year, you're number five, the elementary ministry of parents team A, which is core course. You're talking about 12 weeks, and you got stuff there that looks like it, you know, is 3 years. I feel like I'm more well trained or equipped than anybody else in my whole church to even come close to teaching this kind of stuff, and yet I don't feel like I could begin to teach it. And it gives me a sense of hopelessness that I could go and enter into something like this that you know, their first question to me is, well, what do you do with your kids, John? Well, I'm 30, I don't have any. And that's a legitimate obstacle to overcome and to work with. I'm not afraid of doing that, but there's a real overwhelming impact of it. I mean, it all seems good, but it sounds a little bit like talking to brand new Christians and laying out the Christian life for them in an hour and a half. Maybe it's like, where do I begin? Oh,
And please remember that the course is designed as the door to your parenting ministry. It's the door. And they're not going to come out of the course having understood everything. Just like it's the same thing when Dan and Larry teach the basic first week. I mean, you'd say to Dan and Larry, it's ridiculous that you'd ever have a 1 week course in preparing counselors. And you'd ever try to present all your core material in 1 week. That's so ridiculous. And their answer is, you're right. It's the door. And look at all of you went through the first door and you're at the second one now.
Is it basically like starting a support group using the model that we're using the support group for basically what you're getting
out of that? Sure, and see what you've done is in the basic course, you kind of painted a picture of what it means to be an effective parent. They've got a foggy idea and what gets in the way. And you've kind of built a climate where people can admit, yeah, that's me. That's where I'm at. And now you come along with a group and say, hey, for those of you that really feel like you want to move toward that now, let's work together in a small group and do that. Well, in the small groups, we get together and we don't do much teaching, but what we do is we just let them talk about the problems they're facing. And they just bring out their problems in the group. And we kind of put our heads together and talk about it. Now we're all thinking within the framework of the course. We've got the basic model of the course, and of course we've got a qualified leader that can guide them in a certain direction. And there's a certain point of humility now. You know, because everybody's saying, I'm here and I'm struggling, and there's no one that's sitting there as an expert. What I find is when you get a group of strange parents together, I mean parents that are just together for a night, you know, and you say, let's cool our ignorance. You know, you've got all these experts around that are just putting the other parents down. But that's not the atmosphere in the group. Once you come to the group, you're saying, I need help. And so everybody's really open in the group, and they're talking back and forth.
What kind of clothing do you have in this?
No, we try to go with 10 weeks with them. We start halfway through the course, and then we go 5 more weeks after the course. So we try to meet 10 times. And, if they want to, they can be in another group. But what we do, we try to do is encourage them to be active in their parents and teens and ministry then. And we have a lot of other things that they can be involved in. But if they feel a need, they can go on and be in another group. Now, during that time, I'll see them individually if they want to be seen. I'll see them individually. But, yeah, I'm starting to move that direction. Now, this year I didn't do that, but that's what I'll be doing next fall. I've got to be in a small group to be seen individually. But again, I'm not trying to outline that this is the only way it can be done. I'm just trying to tell you how it's unfolded here at our church. You take it and see how it unfolds at yours. You know, some basic things that we're learning here. Now, it's important to quickly, if you begin this, in point C, that you quickly move to having a leadership team. You just can't do it by yourself. And I think the credibility problem for me, what little credibility problem there was, I'm 35 years old and I got a 10-year-old, and there was a bit of a credibility problem. But part of it, too, is I was kind of brought in as an expert, you know, by our senior pastor and kind of announced that way, and the parents were kind of excited about having someone that's just going to work with them and that kind of thing. So there's a few barriers probably that I didn't have to face that you might have to. But there was a credibility thing. Some of the people were sitting there the first week or two or whatever, and the first course was, you know, they asked a lot of hard questions. They were really testing, you know, as far as, you really believe this stuff, you really know how it applies and that. But out of that first course, there was a real following that developed. Some parents who were really committed to me and my ministry, you know, and it became their ministry. And now those parents, you know, are involved with me. And so now they don't look at it as just this guy doesn't have kids. You know, there's a whole team of us now. And all of them have teenagers. And so we have found that could be a good thing. Now, see, oftentimes it's not possible for parents and teens to get involved in the youth ministry because their own kids are there and don't want them to be involved. But here they can get involved in ministry indirectly to their kids, but to other parents and that kind of thing. So I have committed couples to this ministry like I rarely have had to the youth ministry when I was a youth pastor, you know, working with the kids. I have a commitment that far exceeds, because now these parents really have compassion, and they really know how, you know, their friends are hurting out there and that kind of thing, and they're committed now to they made, you know, my basic three couples made a 3-year commitment to me, and then I have 3 more couples that made a 1-year commitment. And now I'll be taking these 6 couples next year through an additional year of training. And all I plan to do is take them through a mixture of core and counseling adolescence, those two courses. And we're going to be doing it on Wednesday evenings. You know, and they won't go to any kind of other church meeting. These 6 couples will meet with me, and we'll meet for 2 hours every Wednesday evening. That's our plan now. And they will become the leaders of the ministry. Any decision or directions that we make will be made by these particular couples. They're going to be the leaders. Some of them won't be that strong at counseling. I don't know if there'll be a whole lot of counselors come out of this. A couple of them will be good group leaders. A couple of them are just great organizers. So we will plug them in according to where their gifts are at, but I want them all to learn and understand our basic philosophy of ministry, and to have that as a picture that way. Now, in one way, this lay couple that come to my counseling adolescent class, and they're doing over a small church, they're ahead of me. I mean, they're way ahead, man. Their parents are just going great guns, and they've already started doing some things in the community, and we haven't scheduled to do anything out in the community until this next spring. And this next spring now, we will be doing our basic, we will begin to do our basic seminar, no longer in the church. It'll always be in a public school in the evening for 6 Tuesday nights for 2 hours each. And that's our plan to do that. And we just feel before we go public, though, we've got to have our core trained. But we'll never offer it in the church from then on. We'll encourage our church couples to sign up and come out to the public school and do it. But it'll be offered in the public school to rent it. And we'll try to do it in schools where the principal is somewhat supportive of us. We have a lot of principals that just of the public schools that go to our church. So we're going to work through their schools first. Do it, just jump around and do it in 6-week segments. And again, it'll be a whole team teaching it. That's the idea there. That's what we mean under penetration in the community. We did start this spring, and we did this 3 times, what we call neighborhood chats. Let me just cover F here first. I just talked about community seminars. Our neighborhood chats, what those are is that what we did is we told any body that took our basic course, our 12-week course, that they could have an evening in their neighborhood if they wanted to, and that we would come in, these 3 couples that have been my staff this year and myself, we would come in and we would lead a chat, an evening chat just on raising kids, and through it, share Christ. And if anybody wanted to have one at their house, fine, and anybody that wanted to come could come from the church if they brought an unsaved couple with them. So we did it 3 times. We allowed 20 parents at each one. And it became a great... We have seen that through those 3 neighborhood chats, we've seen about 4 couples start into our church. Not accept Christ, but come into our church. They were all unsaved couples. So we're hoping to see them come along soon. But we were just found that a lot of our parents were coming to us saying, well, I've got this guy I work with, and I just would... How in the world can I get exposed to some of this material? So we decided we'd go out... And then we do this on Wednesday evenings, and we do this neighborhood chat. And we'll show up, the 7 of us that are on staff, and then there's a host and hostess, so there's 9 of us, and then we'll have about 12 other parents there, maybe 14 other parents, and just spend the evening chatting together. We might start out by looking at season 6, 1 and 2, and just start off from there about what it means to raise your kids in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Or we might, you know, start off from other texts. And we just open it up and just talk about the struggles and problems of what it's like to raise kids. And we always come back down to the end of coming back to saying, you really can't find the strength apart from a relationship with Christ. That's just the bottom line that we come to. And then we have a long time of coffee and donuts afterwards where we can talk individually with parents. Now, warning, that generates a lot of counseling. I almost always, the next day, on Thursday morning, come in, I've gotten phone calls from 2 or 3 of the couples that were there the night before saying that they could see me individually. So that will generate counseling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, see, now this last year, I didn't have a policy. I had to be part of a small group and that kind of thing. So I've figured out all the ins and outs. But we're having to do more that way as far as saying you got to be part of a small group, that kind of thing. But as far as what we do with the unsaved ones, right now the couples will meet with them. Whoever's overseeing the neighborhood chats will follow up any kind of initial kind of meetings. Well,
right
now I'm kind of the clearinghouse for all of that, and I will see them, or I'll get them to someone that can help them. And that's where E is important, a referral network with counseling resources. You need to develop this if you're going to get into it. You know, it's just amazing the complex kind of situations that you start to get yourself into. You know, they have all kinds of, you know, you have a kid who is running away. What are you going to do with him? You have a kid now who's addicted to drugs. Where are you going to send him? You know, what are you going to do? And it takes a little while to develop that in the community, and it takes also getting involved as far as getting acquainted with some of the other professionals in the community. And we try to provide that for some of the smaller churches around. We try to provide that kind of thing. But we have two psychiatrists that will work with us that will get kids in hospitals for us. They're both Christians. We have this one psychologist that's one of our couples that's available. We have a man who's the chairman of the psychiatric wing at the Akron Children's Hospital. I don't know if he's a Christian, but he works with us, and he will intervene in when we have trouble with a school, with an educational kind of problem, because he's got connections with the school system. So I'll send the team in him, and he'll do kind of a whole battery of tests. I don't do too much in the way of psychological tests, but he'll do it, and he'll document for the school system, this is why this kid needs a special class or needs special treatment. And so we can use that documentation and this particular man's credibility then to get the school system to cooperate with us. So I've had to do that in a few instances. I have a few contacts now at the Children's Services Board. I didn't last July, but I just had to call them a few times. So I know a guy there that I can call and talk to. And I've learned the directors of the juvenile detention centers in the area. So because if we have a kid that's a runaway, unless that kid is just demonstrated as really being potentially dangerous, normally the police and Children's Services Board won't take him out of the home or put him anywhere because it's got a waiting list. But I have found that if I can call the directors, I can get kids in. They'll put extra cops up and that kind of stuff. So there's a lot that you need to develop that way. But as you start out slow and small, you can just kind of build it on the way. It's not that all this has to be in place first. You just build it as you need it. You build these resources, and you find you need a psychiatrist. You look in the yellow pages, you ask around, pastor, do you know anybody, and you just start working. And the network comes together. It's not like all this has to be in place first. I don't want to give you that impression. Now, we have monthly reunions or get-togethers for those that have taken the course. And we call them, you know, coffee shops or workshops, that kind of thing. And we'll do this once a month on a Sunday evening or a Wednesday evening where we will announce a specific topic. And it's primarily for those that have taken the basic course, although we don't stand at the door and say, you know, whatever, but we only advertise it through mailing to the people that have taken the basic course. And we'll handle such topics as, now these are topics we don't have time to deal with in the basic course. We don't talk much about these. Preparing your teen for healthy dating. You know, believe it or not, we don't even have time to touch dating, hardly, in the basic course. Helping your adolescent develop a healthy self-image. Shaping your child's sexual identity. Controlling the effects of media on your kids. We'll just kind of take a hot topic, and we'll get them out as a parent, and just another way of maintaining contact with them, of getting them back in, doing that kind of thing. We've got several parents that come back and take the course over and over again before they actually ever get in a small group. Now, very quickly, I think I've probably hit on most of these cautions or limitations already, but let me just answer a couple here, or just mention a couple really quickly. Number one, be careful about this whole pull of parents to give them cookbook approaches. Number two, be careful about becoming the answer man and doing all your parents' thinking for them. It's very easy for parents to call you on the phone and say, real quickly, Kevin, I just wanted what your opinion was for this. What should we do in this situation? And I just don't like to do that very much. I just don't like to do it very much. If I really sense it's a kind of urgent emergency kind of thing, it's kind of a very unique situation, I might do that. But I really kind of try to encourage the parents to think through themselves on it. So it's their decision. Because I'm liable. You know, if I tell them, you do this in this situation, Now, I'm liable if, you know, disaster strikes, a kid commits suicide. You know, Kevin told us to do this, and the kid committed suicide. So I would not, that's not my primary reason. My primary reason is I want the parents to learn to think on their own. I don't want them to be dependent on me. So be careful not to become the answer man. Be careful about expanding too quickly your parents' ministry. It's okay to start small and let it grow very slowly. Be careful about expanding too quickly because you really need a team approach. You need to develop a team. Fourth is be sure you have the support of your senior pastor. Because this will get controversial. Working with parents of teens. You'll have parents get mad at you for certain stands you take, and that. And parents will come and want a cookbook approach, and when you turn it around, you know, like I had one particular man who's just a famous Christian in our community and a very big executive. And he came in because he wanted me to give him four good ways to control his son. And it was very, obvious from the very beginning that, his wife was there against her will, and it became obvious that he didn't have two rebellious teenagers, he had three as he counted his wife. And I just asked her a few questions, and she just, you know, basically told me that she was fed up with him and all this stuff. And when I suggested to him that the problem would begin with working on the marriage and working with some personal kinds of things, I mean, he just got up, cussed me out, and left the office. Next week, he had lunch with our senior pastor. And just to tell him that Huggins is kind of off the wall, and who's he to tell me it's my problem, and those kind of things. So, you know, make sure you have the support of your senior pastor because these things will happen. You know, you'll have this kind of thing. Well, I'm done with my notes here, and we have run out of time. I guess I could take a quick question. Okay, this January, I'll teach the Counseling Adolescent course. It's a two-week course, and it'll be during their winterim period in January. I don't know what the dates are, but it's usually like the second and third week of January kind of thing. We'll teach the course. Yes, great seminar. No, you would have to enroll as a special student. If you want to just come in town for those 2 weeks, though, and you haven't had Larry's basic core course, you need to get special permission from him. Because that's the prerequisite. You got to be in core. You have to have taken at least one semester of core to be in counseling adolescents. Now, if you've been to the basic one and the advanced one, I don't think you have any trouble getting permission. But you still have to get permission from Larry to get in the course, counseling adolescent course.